resources of Israel, the United States, and 40 other countries, had been assassinated literally right beneath their intelligence headquarters. Some of the building's windows were shattered by the explosion. "Just think what this does to the Syrians," said Dagan, "right in the heart of the most guarded place in Damascus. Think of what it does to Assad, what it does to Hezbollah, when they grasp that they're not safe even in Damascus. You give the adversary a sense of total intelligence penetration, a sense that you know everything, both about the organization and about the host country," he added. President Assad realized the magnitude of the disaster and wanted to keep as far away as possible from the whole affair. He sent condolences to Nasrallah, but suggested that no mention of the attack be made in Syria. He even suggested that the wrecked Pajero, with the body placed in it, be transferred under cover of night to Beirut, to make it look as if Mukhniyeh had died there. Nasrallah refused. He was furious with the Syrians for failing to look after his comrade. Some Hezbollah members, as well as Mukhniyeh's wife, even accused the Syrians wrongly of being involved in the killing. Assad was forced to deny and apologize over and over again. Nasrallah issued orders that no Syrian representatives be invited to the funeral in Beirut. Mukhniyeh's funeral was held in pouring rain. The procession of Shiite mourners encountered Sunnis, who had just taken part in a memorial for their beloved leader, Rafiq Hariri, who had been murdered on Mukhniyeh's orders exactly 3 years before. Such is life in Lebanon. Thousands managed to cram into the enormous hangar in South Beirut where Hezbollah occasionally held its larger rallies. Tens of thousands were left outside. Mukhniyeh's casket was carried to the podium while the mourners reached out and tried to touch it, to be blessed by his honor and holiness on his final journey. An honor guard of Hezbollah militiamen in khaki uniforms flanked the casket on the podium, together with the sober-faced leaders of the organization, dressed in their black robes. On the walls, and in the hands of the mourners, were thousands of posters bearing the last photograph of Mukhniyeh, which only now, after his death, was allowed to be revealed. The caption read, "The Great Martyred Hero." The crowd cried out in grief for revenge. Faithful to the wishes of his departed comrade, Nasrallah remained in his bunker and did not appear at the funeral. Giant screens transmitted his eulogy to the masses, inside and outside the hangar. In solemn words, he eulogized his top fighter, who devoted his life to martyrdom, but waited many years to become a martyr himself. He mentioned the assassination of his predecessor as Secretary General, Abbas Mousawi, which had only strengthened the resistance and led to more and more humiliation for Israel. "The Israelis do not realize what the blood of Sheikh Abbas did for Hezbollah, the emotional and spiritual uniqueness that it gave us," he said. "Let the world write down, and upon my responsibility, that with Mukhniyeh becoming a shaheed, we have to historically mark the beginning of the fall of the State of Israel." The crowd responded, "We are at your service, O Nasrallah." Nasrallah ended with a threat. "You crossed the borders, Zionists. If you want an open war, a war outside of the borders of Israel and Lebanon, let it be an open war anywhere." Nasrallah and the Iranians appointed at least 4 people to take over Mukhniyeh's duties. But the open war never came to pass. The same intelligence penetration that had allowed a bomb to be planted in Mukhniyeh's Pajero also allowed Israel to stop all of Hezbollah's planned attacks. Only one succeeded, a suicide terrorist who blew himself up next to a busload of Israeli tourists in Bulgaria, killing 6 and wounding 30. In his death, the legends about Mukhniyeh proved to have been true. His operational capabilities were greater than those of the entire quartet that replaced him taken together, said Dagan. Mukhniyeh's absence was made especially conspicuous by the organization's inability to respond to the assassination. "If Mukhniyeh was around to avenge his own death," an Amman officer said, "the situation would likely have been completely different. Lucky for us, he wasn't." In less than 6 months, General Suleiman had lost a nuclear facility he'd managed to keep secret for 5 years, and a close confidant and ally who'd cheated death for decades. Humiliated and furious, he ordered Scud missiles, some armed with chemical warheads, prepared for launch into Israel. He demanded that Assad strike back with aggression. Assad refused. He understood his general's rage, but he also understood that an open attack on Israel, to say nothing of a chemical attack, was not in Syria's best interests. This behavior took discipline, Olmert observed in a meeting with House Minority Leader John Boehner. Bashar is no dummy. Olmert told his close advisers that Assad, the man we all love to hate, is displaying moderation and pragmatism in his response. Like Assad, Olmert was forced to moderate his underlings, many of whom believed Assad should be killed too. After all, he had aligned himself with terrorists and Iranians. All the stories about the progressive Western eye doctor had turned out to be wishful thinking, one high-ranking Amman officer said. We have here an extremist leader, and unlike his father, he's unstable, with a tendency for dangerous adventures. But Olmert rejected the idea. It is precisely with this man, he said, that a peace agreement can be reached. Suleiman was a different case. Suleiman was a real shit, with a remarkable capability for organization and maneuvering, Olmert said. In many respects, Suleiman was the second strongest man in Syria, with an office across the hall from Assad's in the presidential palace and, as a top-secret NSA memo noted, a hand in three primary areas: internal Syrian issues connected to the regime and the party, sensitive military issues, and Lebanon-related issues through which he was apparently connected both to Hezbollah and to others in the Lebanese political arena. This time, though, the Israelis knew there was no chance the United States would get involved. Mukhniya, who had killed hundreds of Americans, was one thing. A Syrian general, the high-ranking official of a sovereign state, was something entirely different. On their own, then, the Israelis began planning a way to dispose of Suleiman. After the Mukhniya operation, security arrangements in Damascus had been stepped up, and any idea of conducting the operation there was ruled out. Suleiman was closely guarded and constantly escorted by a convoy of armored vehicles, so the possibility of using an explosive device was also rejected. Meir Dagan reached the conclusion that the Mossad would need assistance, and, as it happened, the IDF was eager to take on the job. The glory bestowed on the Mossad after Mukhniya's killing had stoked the military leaders' desire to carry out the assassination of a key figure themselves, so that the finger on the trigger would be of a soldier, not a Mossad man. On Friday, August 1, 2008, at about 4 p.m., Suleiman ended his day's work at the palace earlier than usual and set out northward in his secure convoy. He was heading to the summer residence he had built on the Mediterranean coast near the port city of Tartus. It was a spacious villa with a large patio of polished stone overlooking the sea. That evening, the general invited a number of local dignitaries to dine with him and his wife, Rahab, and his close advisors. They were attended by a staff of servants and, of course, bodyguards. The party was sitting at a round table, with a magnificent view of the sun setting into the sea. Suleiman's wife sat to his left, his chef de bureau on his right. Two men smoked fat Cuban cigars. Suddenly, the general lurched back in his chair, then hurled forward, and fell face down onto his plate. His skull was split open, fragments of bone and flecks of brain matter and blood splattering all over Rahab. He'd been shot 6 times, first in the chest, the throat, and the center of his forehead, then 3 times in the back. Only Suleiman was hit. He was dead before his face hit the plate. Within 30 seconds, the two Flotilla 13 snipers who had fired the shots from 2 different spots on the beach were already on rubber dinghies, headed to a Navy vessel. Back on the beach, they had left behind some cheap Syrian cigarettes, part of a disinformation campaign, to make the assassination look like an internal Syrian affair. As a frantic search for the shooters got underway in the villa, the commander of Suleiman's bodyguards called the presidential palace to notify Assad that his closest advisor had been killed. 6 bullets, from 2 directions, and no one ever saw the assassins. Assad listened and remained silent for a minute. "What has happened," he said firmly. "This is a military secret of the highest level. Bury him now, straight away, without telling anyone, and that is that." The funeral was held the next day, in utmost secrecy. This was the first known instance of Israel targeting a legitimate government official, the NSA concluded. Meir Dagan was now the head of a completely different Mossad from the one he had inherited 6 years earlier. No longer the timid institution unnerved by its own failed and sloppy operations, Dagan's Mossad had infiltrated Hezbollah and Suleiman's shadow army, disrupted the transfer of weapons and advanced technologies between members of the Radical Front, killed Radical Front activists, and even assassinated the long-sought Imad Mughniyeh. Dagan had also developed a plan to stall Iran's nuclear ambitions, which thus far had proven remarkably successful. It was a 5-pronged approach: heavy international diplomatic pressure, economic sanctions, support to Iranian minorities and opposition groups to help them topple the regime, the disruption of consignments of equipment and raw materials for the nuclear program, and finally, covert ops, including the sabotage of installations and targeted killings of key figures in the program. The idea behind this integrated effort, a series of pinpoint operations meant to change reality, in Dagan's words, was to delay the project as much as possible so that before Iran could build an atom bomb, either the sanctions would cause a grave economic crisis that would force Iran's leaders to drop the project, or the opposition parties would be strong enough to overthrow the government. In support of these efforts, the quadrilateral collaboration between the CIA, the NSA, the Mossad, and Amman was finally formalized by way of a cooperation pact between Bush and Olmert that included revealing sources and methods, total mutual striptease, in the words of one of the Prime Minister's aides. American intelligence agencies and the Department of the Treasury, together with the Mossad's spear unit, launched a comprehensive campaign of economic measures to impair the Iranian nuclear project. The two countries also embarked on an effort to identify Iranian purchases of equipment for the project, particularly items that Iran could not manufacture itself, and to stop the shipments from reaching their destination. This continued for years, through the Bush administration and into that of Barack Obama. But the Iranians were tenacious. In June 2009, the Mossad, together with U.S. and French intelligence, discovered that they had built another secret uranium enrichment facility, this one at Qom. Publicly, 3 months later, President Obama made a dramatic announcement and condemnation, and the economic sanctions were tightened further. Covertly, joint sabotage operations also managed to produce a series of breakdowns in Iranian equipment supplied to the nuclear project. Computers stopped working. Transformers burned out. Centrifuges simply didn't work properly. In the largest and most important joint operation by the Americans and the Israelis against Iran, dubbed Olympic Games, computer viruses, one of which became known as Stuxnet, caused severe damage to the nuclear project's uranium enrichment machinery. The last component of Dagan's plan, the targeted killing of scientists, was implemented by the Mossad on its own, since Dagan was aware that the United States would not agree to participate. The Mossad compiled a list of 15 key researchers, mostly members of the weapons group that was responsible for developing a detonation device for the weapons as targets for elimination. On January 14, 2007, Dr. Ardashir Hassanpour, a 44-year-old nuclear scientist working at the Isfahan uranium plant, died under mysterious circumstances. The official announcement of his death noted that he had been asphyxiated following a gas leak, but Iranian intelligence is convinced that he was a victim of the Israelis. On January 12, 2010, at 8:10 a.m., Massoud Alimohammadi left his home in an affluent North Tehran neighborhood and walked toward his car. He had been awarded a doctorate in the field of elementary particle physics in 1992 by Sharif University of Technology and became a senior lecturer there. Later, he joined the nuclear project, where he was one of the top scientists. As he opened his car door, a booby-trapped motorcycle that was parked nearby exploded, killing him. The slaying of scientists, people working in government positions for a sovereign state, who were not involved in terrorism in any way, did not go without an internal debate in the Mossad. At one of the operational approval meetings in Dagan's office, an intelligence officer working under the deputy director, Tamir Pardo, stood up and said that her father was a top scientist in Israel's nuclear program. "Going by the way of thinking prevalent here," she asserted, "my father would be a legitimate target for elimination. I think that this is neither moral nor legal." But all such objections were rebuffed. The Iranians, for their part, realized that someone was killing their scientists and began guarding them closely, especially the chief of the weapons group, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was considered the brains behind the project. The Iranians posted cars full of cops around their homes, making their lives a nightmare and pitching them and their families into profound anxiety. The series of successful operations also had an additional effect, one that Israel did not initiate, but that ended up working to its great benefit. Each member of the Radical Front began to fear that Israel had penetrated their ranks, and thus started devoting huge efforts to locating their leaks and trying to protect their personnel against the Mossad. The Iranians also became paranoid about the possibility that all the equipment and materials they'd acquired on the black market for their nuclear project, for very large sums of money, were infected. And they examined and re-examined each item over and over. These efforts greatly slowed down other aspects of the nuclear project, even bringing some to a standstill. Dagan's Mossad was now once again the Mossad of legend, the agency that historically had been either feared or admired, but never dismissed. The staff were proud to be serving there. Dagan had introduced a boldness to the agency that would have been bravado had it not been so completely and utterly effective. Chapter 35. Impressive Tactical Success, Disastrous Strategic Failure. Mahmoud Al-Mabou entered the lobby of the Al-Bustan Rotana Hotel just before 8:30 in the evening, one of many guests coming and going at the hotel. Like them, he was captured by the closed-circuit camera over the entrance. He had black hair, a slightly receding hairline, and a thick black mustache. He wore a black shirt and a coat a little too large for him. It was a relatively cold night in Dubai, which is usually very warm. He'd been in Dubai for less than 6 hours, but already he'd met with a banker who was helping him arrange various international financial transactions required to purchase special surveillance equipment for Hamas in Gaza. He'd also met with his regular contact from the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, who flew in to coordinate the delivery of 2 large shipments of weapons to the extremist Islamic organization. Al-Mabou did a lot of business in Dubai. When he flew into the little city-state on January 12, 2010, it was at least his 5th visit in a little less than a year. He traveled on a Palestinian passport. The emirate was one of the few places that recognized papers issued by the Palestinian Authority, which listed a fake name and a fake occupation. In reality, he was a top Hamas operative and had been for decades. 20 years earlier, he'd kidnapped and murdered 2 Israeli soldiers, and more recently, after his predecessor, Izz al-Din al-Sheikh Khalil, had been disposed of by the Mossad in Damascus, he'd been in charge of stocking Hamas armories. A step or two behind Al-Mabou, there was a man with a cell phone, following him into the elevator. "Coming now," the man said into his phone. Al-Mabo might have overheard, but he didn't seem to notice. There was nothing unusual about a tourist in Dubai telling a friend he was on his way. Al-Mabo was by nature an extremely cautious man. He knew that the Israelis wanted to kill him. "You have to be alert," he told Al Jazeera in an interview the previous spring. "And me, praise Allah, they call me the fox because I can sense what is behind me, even what is behind that wall. Praise God, I have a highly developed sense of security. But we know what the price of our path is, and we have no problem with it. I hope that I get to die a martyr's death." The elevator stopped at the second floor. Al-Mabu stepped off. The man with the phone stayed on, going to a higher floor. Definitely a tourist. Al-Mabu turned left and walked toward his room, 230. The hallway was empty. Out of habit, he quickly scanned the frame of his door and the lock mechanism, looking for nicks, scratches, any hint of tampering. There was nothing. He entered the room, closed the door behind him. He heard a noise and turned to see what it was. Too late. The plan for the assassination of Mahmoud Al-Mabo had been approved 4 days earlier, on January 15, during a hastily arranged meeting in the large conference room near Mayor Dagan's office, after Israeli military intelligence had hacked into the email server used by Al-Mabu and discovered that he'd reserved a flight from Damascus to Dubai on January 19. In that meeting, there were some 15 people seated around a long table, including representatives of the Mossad's intelligence, technology, and logistics wings. The most important person at the conference, after Dagan, was Holiday, the head of Kisaraya. Holiday, who was bald and stocky, had taken it upon himself to personally command Operation Plasma Screen. Al-Mabo had long been on the Israelis' kill list. A year earlier, the situation on the Gaza Strip border had deteriorated so badly that on December 27, 2008, Israel launched Operation Cast Lead, a large-scale attack to stop Hamas from raining Qassam and Katyusha rockets down on Israeli communities. Hamas was able to fire a great deal of ordnance from the Gaza Strip, thanks to Al-Mabo's weapons acquisition and transportation network, and the assistance it received from the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. Israel's intelligence about Hamas had improved greatly in recent years, and the operation began with the Air Force's huge aerial bombardment, codenamed Birds of Prey, on the silos where Hamas's rockets were concealed. The Mossad had learned that the network Al-Mabo managed had been replenishing the Hamas weapons stockpiles. The weapons were shipped from Iran to Port Sudan on the Red Sea, and from there smuggled via Egypt and Sinai into the Gaza Strip via the multiple tunnels used to avoid the Egyptian border guards and patrols. The Mossad kept track of the shipments at sea and when the trucks left Port Sudan. In January 2009, the Israeli Air Force carried out 4 long-range raids and destroyed the convoys and the men escorting them. "Activities like these did a lot of damage to the smuggling routes from Iran to Hamas," Dagan said. "Not an absolute impact, not enough to win outright, but a significant reduction." For some reason, however, Al-Mabo did not travel that day with the trucks, but instead left Sudan by another route. To rectify this, Dagan requested and obtained approval from Olmert for a negative treatment operation against Al-Mabu. When Benjamin Netanyahu took over from Olmert in March 2009, he renewed the approval. Dubai was the most convenient place to kill Al-Mabu. The other areas where he spent time, Tehran, Damascus, Sudan, and China, had efficient secret services and posed far more problems for a Mossad hit team. Dubai, on the other hand, was teeming with tourists and foreign businessmen and had, the Mossad believed, much weaker enforcement and intelligence forces. Dubai was still a target country, officially hostile to Israel, but by this point the Mossad had killed a man in downtown Damascus and a Syrian general in his own villa. By comparison, a Hamas operative in touristy Dubai would be a relatively easy target. Still, the operation called for a large team, divided into smaller squads, which would be able to spot the target when he arrived in Dubai and keep him under surveillance while others set up and executed the actual hit in the hotel room, making sure it would appear that Al-Mabo had died a natural death. They would then need to remove all evidence and leave the country before the body was found, just in case foul play was suspected anyway. Not everyone thought that Almabo was important enough to justify the effort and risk. Some even told Dagon that he did not meet the basic conditions required for negative treatment. Everybody in the Mossad agreed that Almabo deserved to die, but in order to carry out an operation in a target country, he also had to be a serious danger to Israel, one whose elimination would have a profoundly disruptive effect on the enemy's equilibrium. In truth, Almabo did not fit either criterion. But after all of their previous success, Dagon and other Mossad officials were so full of self-confidence that they went forward anyway. A team of Kisaraya operatives had first trailed Almabo in Dubai in 2009, not to kill him, but to study his movements and, mostly, to be certain that he was their man. 4 months later, in November, the plasma screen crew went to Dubai again, this time to eliminate him. They poisoned a drink that was brought to his hotel room, but either they got the dose wrong or he didn't swallow enough. Almabo only fainted. When he came to, he cut short his visit and returned to Damascus, where a doctor attributed his fainting spell to mononucleosis. He accepted this diagnosis and didn't suspect that an attempt on his life had been made. This turn of events caused profound frustration within the Mossad. People and resources had been risked, and still the job had not been finished. Holliday insisted that there would be no mistakes this time. The hit squad would not leave Dubai before they saw with their own eyes that Almabo was dead. One objection arose at the January 15 meeting near Mayor Dagon's office. The documentation department would have trouble preparing credible new fake passports for the entire team. There were more than 24 people going to Dubai, and some would be entering the same country with the same identities and cover stories for the third time in barely 6 months. In the Mossad's more timid days, under Halevi, the operation would have been canceled for that reason alone. But Dagon and Holliday decided to take the risk. They would send the team in with the existing papers. Holliday didn't expect any problems anyway. The discovery of the body was liable to arouse suspicion, and an investigation might ensue, he acknowledged. But that would happen only long after the team had returned to Israel. Zero evidence would be left for the police to work with. No secret of the Mossad would be given away. No one would be caught. The whole thing would be forgotten quickly. Dagon dictated the final decision to his chief assistant. Plasma screen. Authorized for execution. As the participants left, he added in his deep voice, "And the best of luck to all." The first three members of the plasma screen team landed in Dubai at 6:45 on the morning of January 18. Over the next 19 hours, the rest of the team, at least 27 members altogether, arrived on flights from Zurich, Rome, Paris, and Frankfurt. 12 of their passports were British, 6 Irish, 4 French, 4 Australian, and 1 German. All were genuine, but none actually belonged to the person using it. Some were borrowed from their owners, residents of Israel with dual citizenship. Some were obtained under false identities. Some were stolen, and others belonged to the deceased. At 2:09 a.m. on the 19th, Gail Folliard and Kevin Daveron landed. They were to be the main pivots for the operation, controlling the forward command room, the communications personnel, the guards, and the lookouts. They checked into separate rooms at the Jumeirah Hotel. Both paid cash, though many of the other team members used debit cards issued by a company called Payoneer, the CEO of which was a veteran of an IDF commando unit. The reception clerk Sri Rahayu took their money and gave Folliard room number 1102 and Daveron 3308. Before going to sleep, Folliard ordered a light meal from room service. Daveron took a soft drink from his minibar. Peter Elvinger, the commander of the mission, landed at the airport 21 minutes after Folliard and Daveron, carrying a French passport. After clearing passport control, Elvinger pulled a counter-surveillance maneuver, Maslul in Hebrew, exiting through the terminal door, waiting 3 minutes, then turning around and going back inside for a predetermined meeting with another team member who had come to the airport earlier by car. All members of a hit team as a standard procedure. Constantly used maslul. Frequently changing clothing and disguises, such as wigs and false mustaches. This is to make sure that one is not being followed and to enable a switch of identities between various stages of an operation. Elvinger and his contact spoke for less than a minute before the commander took a cab to his hotel. By early afternoon, the entire team was waiting tensely for the arrival of Almabo. He was expected to fly in at 3 o'clock, but there were still some gaps in the intelligence. The plasma screen team did not know where he would be staying, when and where he would be having meetings, or how he would move from place to place. The team, which couldn't cover the whole city, might lose him, and it was impossible to plan in advance how to get close enough to kill him. It's the kind of hit, a veteran operative said, where the target dictates how and when he is to be made dead. Some of the team members had deployed to 3 hotels where Almabo had stayed in his previous visits. Another surveillance squad was at the airport, passing time with what appeared to be idle telephone chatter. The remaining personnel, 7 people, remained with Elvinger in another hotel, waiting. Almabo arrived at 3:35. A team tailed him to the Albastan Rotana Hotel, and a message was sent to the operatives at the other hotels, telling them they were clear to leave their posts. The team members made extensive use of cell phones, but in order to avoid direct links between their numbers, they dialed a number in Austria, where a simple switchboard installed in advance put the call through, either to another phone in Dubai or to the command post in Israel. The crew members already in the lobby of the Albastan Rotana were wearing tennis clothes and carrying rackets, though, curiously, without the usual accompanying covers. After Almabo got his room key, 2 of them entered the elevator after him. When he got out on the 2nd floor, they followed at a discreet distance and noted that he was staying in room 230. One of the 2 men reported this by way of a cell phone call routed through Austria before the 2 returned to the lobby. Once Elvinger knew Almabo's room number, he made 2 phone calls. The first was to the Albastan Rotana to book a room. He asked for 237, directly across the corridor from 230. Then he called an airline to reserve a seat on a flight to Munich via Qatar later that evening. A little after 4 p.m., Almabo left the hotel. The team trailing him noticed he was taking precautionary measures, doing his own kind of maslul. He had good reason to do this. Almost all of his comrades in Hamas since the late 1980s had died unnatural deaths. But his moves were simple and unsophisticated, and the team had no trouble keeping eyes on him. Kevin Davaron waited in the Albastan lobby for Elvinger, who arrived at 4:25, handed Davaron a suitcase without a word, and then went to the registration desk. The security camera clearly captured his red-covered European Union passport. After checking into room 237, he gave the key to Davaron, again without a word, and left the hotel without his suitcase. 2 hours later, 4 men came to the hotel, in 2 pairs. All wore baseball caps that hid their faces. They carried 2 large bags. 3 of them were Kisaraya executioners. The 4th was an expert at picking locks. They went directly to the elevators and to room 237. An hour after that, at 7:43, the surveillance team in the lobby was relieved, replaced with fresh eyes. 4 hours after they'd first arrived, the fake tennis players finally left the lobby. At 10 o'clock, the crew tailing Almabo reported that he was heading back to the hotel. Davaron and Folliard kept watch in the corridor while the lockpicker began working the lock on the door to 230. The idea was to reprogram it so a Mossad master key would open the door without being logged, but at the same time, not disrupt the normal functioning of the proper key. A tourist stepped off the elevator, but Davaron quickly engaged him in some innocent, distracting conversation. The tourist saw nothing, the lock was picked, and the team entered the room. Then they waited. Almabo tried to escape back into the corridor, but 2 pairs of strong arms gripped him. A 3rd man gagged him with 1 hand and, with the other, pressed to Almabo's neck an instrument that uses ultrasound waves to inject medication without breaking the skin. The instrument was loaded with succinylcholine chloride, an anesthetic known commercially as scoline that is used in combination with other drugs in surgery. On its own, it induces paralysis and, because it causes the muscles used in breathing to stop working, asphyxiation. The men maintained their grip until Alamabo stopped struggling. As the paralysis spread through his body, they laid him on the floor. Alamabo was wide awake, thinking clearly, seeing and hearing everything. He just couldn't move. Foam formed at the corners of his mouth. He gurgled. Three strangers stared at him dispassionately, still lightly holding his arms just in case. That was the last thing he saw. The executioners checked his pulse in two places, as they had been instructed to do by a Mossad doctor, making sure that this time he was really dead. They removed his shoes, shirt, and trousers, placed them neatly in the closet, and put the body into the bed, under the covers. The entire episode took 20 minutes. Using a technique developed by the Mossad for such occasions, the team closed the door in such a way that it seemed to have been locked from the inside, with the chain slid into place. They hung a Do Not Disturb sign on the door handle, knocked twice on the door of 237 as a mission accomplished signal, and then disappeared into the elevators. Folliard left 1 minute later, Daveron 4 minutes after that, then the surveillance team in the lobby. Within 4 hours, most of the team was out of Dubai and none were left 24 hours later. In Tel Aviv, a mood of self-satisfaction reigned, an atmosphere that was later described as the euphoria of a historic success. Everyone involved, Meir Dagan, Holiday, the hit team, believed another mission had been expertly accomplished. Dagan reported the kill to Netanyahu. Alamabo, he said, won't bother us anymore. Hotel security found the body the next afternoon, after no one answered the maid's repeated knocks throughout the day. There did not seem to be any cause for alarm, however. A middle-aged merchant dead in bed in a locked room with no signs of struggle or trauma was likely indicative of nothing more than a heart attack or maybe a stroke. Alamabo's body was taken to the morgue, his death recorded, and catalogued under the bogus name on his passport. The matter was given no more or less attention than any other dead middle-class foreigner in Dubai. In Damascus, however, Hamas officials were beginning to wonder why the man they'd sent to broker several arms deals hadn't reported back as scheduled. A day later, on January 21, a local envoy asked around at police stations and morgues until he found Alamabo's unclaimed body in a refrigerated drawer. A Hamas official contacted the Dubai police chief, Lieutenant General Dahi Khalfan Tamim, and told him that the dead man with a Palestinian passport was, in fact, a top member of their organization. He told Khalfan that the death almost certainly had not been from natural causes, and that, more likely than not, the Mossad had been behind it. Khalfan, 59 years old and highly decorated, had made it his personal mission to rid his country of criminals and foreign agents who used Dubai as a base for carrying out illegal activity. "Take yourselves," he yelled into the phone, "and your bank accounts, and your arms, and your fucking counterfeit passports, and get the hell out of my country." Still, he couldn't have the Mossad wandering around killing people either. Khalfan pulled the body out of the morgue for an autopsy. The results were not definitive, and it was not possible to determine whether Alamabo had been murdered. But Khalfan's basic assumption was that the Hamas official had been right. One disadvantage Israeli operatives have, in comparison with their American or British counterparts, is that they have to use fake passports. A CIA squad can easily be outfitted with legitimate U.S. State Department passports, albeit under assumed names, and they essentially have an endless supply, one identity just buried under the next as needed. American and British passports are accepted everywhere in the world and rarely draw undue attention. Israeli passports are not. They are useless for getting into many Asian and African countries, countries where the Mossad is occasionally interested in killing someone or conducting some other covert op. The Mossad commonly forges copies from other, less suspicious countries. In the post-9/11 world, however, counterfeiting passports had become a more complicated business. Documents that were sloppily made or have been used too often could endanger a mission and operatives' lives. So when Halevi scrubbed missions for lack of enough proper papers, it wasn't solely out of timidity. And when Dagan bullied rushed passports and identities from reluctant technicians, that was bold leadership only until it went horribly wrong. Dagan had allowed the plasma screen team to use the same identities 4 times in Dubai. It was not difficult for Khalfan to get a list of everyone who entered the UAE shortly before Al-Mabo and then left right after he died. Nor was it difficult to narrow that list down by comparing it with those who came and went the previous 3 times Al-Mabo visited. That gave Khalfan names, which could then be cross-referenced with hotel registries, which almost always have cameras recording the front desk. Soon the police knew who came when, where they stayed, and what they looked like. Assassins prefer cash because it is anonymous. It generally cannot be traced. Credit cards, or prepaid Payoneer debit cards, can be. A cluster of calls to an Austrian switchboard will be logged and, if someone is looking, noticed. So too will the numbers that the switchboard calls. Reconstructing the movement of every Mossad operative in plasma screen and the connections among them, therefore, was not terribly difficult. It only required sifting through a lot of data. From multiple CCTV cameras, Khalfan assembled a video narrative of the entire operation. It included bits of clumsy mazlul for good measure. For instance, the camera above the door to one hotel's bathroom showed Davaran entering bald and coming out with a full head of hair, without even noticing that he was on camera, although it was not hidden. This was not something that would have given the team away in real time, but the sloppy execution of the identity switch certainly made things easier for the investigators. Khalfan then held a press conference and put the entire video on the internet for the world to see. He called on Dagan to be a man and own up to the hit. He demanded international arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Dagan, and Interpol actually did issue arrest warrants for all 27 members, though under their assumed names. The countries whose passports Israel had used were furious. Many of them quietly cooperated with the Mossad, but not to the point of allowing their citizens, fictitious or not, to be dragged into assassination plots. Some governments ordered the Mossad representatives in their countries to leave immediately and would not allow the agency to replace them for several years. All of them cut back on their collaboration with the Israeli agency. It was a calamity born of hubris. "I love Israel and I love the Israelis," said one of the former chiefs of German intelligence. "But your problem has always been that you disparage everyone, the Arabs, the Iranians, Hamas. You're always the smartest and think that you can fool everyone all of the time. A little more respect for the other side, even if you think that he's an ignorant Arab or an unimaginative German, and a little more modesty would have saved all of us from this awkward mess." On one level, none of that mattered in Israel. The harsh condemnations it was subjected to on the international stage, combined with similar condemnations the nation regularly received for its treatment of the Palestinians, produced an upsurge of patriotism. On Israel's carnival holiday, Purim, which fell a few weeks after the story broke, a popular costume was that of a pistol-packing tennis player. Hundreds of Israelis with dual citizenship volunteered their passports to the Mossad for use in future operations. The organization's website was flooded with inquiries about joining up. Things were different, however, inside the agency. The exposure and the negative attention the Mossad got was terribly damaging on an operational level, despite the fact that Khalfan never managed to prosecute any of the perpetrators. Whole sections of the Mossad's operations were shut down, both because so many operatives had had their cover blown and because of the need to develop new procedures and methodologies after the old ones had been all over the media. Early in July 2010, realizing that the Dubai affair had blocked his run to become head of the Mossad, Isaiah Chief Holliday quit. Meanwhile, Mayor Dagan adopted a business-as-usual attitude. In general, Dagan definitely believed that, in certain cases, the Mossad's director has to hand over the keys if he's got a mishap that harms the state, because that would ease the pressure on the country. But from Dagan's point of view, nothing had happened. No foul-up, no mistakes. We hit an important target, he's dead, and all the troops got home, he summed up after the operation. Only in 2013, in an interview for this book, would Dagan admit for the first time that I was wrong in sending the team in with those passports. It was my decision, and only my decision. I bear the full responsibility for what happened. As the Dubai fiasco unfolded, Netanyahu felt a sense of déjà vu, one of his close aides said, as if 1997 was happening all over again. Back then, the Mossad had assured him it could go into a soft target country, Jordan, and cleanly eliminate Khaled Mashal. That ended in humiliation and capitulation. There was no telling how long the fallout from Dubai would last. He had to restrain the Mossad, he decided, and greenlight fewer dangerous missions. In addition, Dagan had to be reined in. The two men had never gotten along. Indeed, Netanyahu's relations with all of the intelligence community chiefs were problematic. Netanyahu doesn't rely on anyone, and so he made covert diplomatic moves without informing the heads of the community, said Netanyahu's national security advisor, Uzi Arad. From one moment to the next, I watched the rift of distrust opening up between him and them. Dagan, for his part, thought the prime minister was too hesitant to approve operations, and yet also fearful of being seen as hesitant, a bundle of neuroses unfit for keeping a nation secure. But Dagan remained at the Mossad. The campaign against Iran, multi-pronged and interconnected and complicated, was still in play. In fact, after the successful hit on Massoud al-Mohammadi earlier in January, Dagan asked Netanyahu for approval to intensify the campaign and to continue killing the remaining 13 scientists of the weapons group. Netanyahu, apprehensive about another imbroglio, was in no hurry. It wasn't until October that he gave the green light for another hit. On November 29, 2010, two motorcyclists blew up the cars of two senior figures in the Iranian nuclear project by attaching limpet mines to them and speeding away. Dr. Majid Shahriari was killed by the blast in his Peugeot 206. Fereydoun Abbasi Devani and his wife, who was also in the car, managed to escape his Peugeot 206 before it exploded just outside Shahi Beheshti University. By this point, however, it had become evident that the targeted killing campaign, along with the economic sanctions and the computer sabotage, had slowed but not stopped the Iranian nuclear program. The program reached a point far beyond what I had hoped for, Defense Minister Ehud Barak said. He and Netanyahu both concluded that Iran was nearing the moment when the project's installations would be indestructible, and they agreed that Israel should act to destroy the facilities before that happened. They ordered the IDF and the intelligence arms to prepare for Operation Deep Waters, an all-out air attack supported by commando forces in the heart of Iran. Some $2 billion was spent on preparations for the attack and for the anticipated ensuing war against the Radical Front. Dagan, among others, thought the plan was insane. He saw it as a cynical move by two politicians who wanted to exploit the widespread public support that the attack would provide them in the next elections, not a level-headed decision based on national interest. Bibi learned a technique, the essence of which was to convey messages in a short time. He reached a remarkable level of mastery and control on this, but he is also the worst manager that I know. He has a certain trait, similar to Ehud Barak. Each of them imagines that he is the world's greatest genius. Netanyahu is the only prime minister in the country's history who reached the situation where the entire defense establishment failed to accept his position. I've known a lot of prime ministers, Dagan said. Not one of them was a saint, believe me. but they all had one thing in common. When they reached the point where the personal interest came up against the national interest, it was the national interest that always won. There was absolutely no question. Only about these two, I cannot say it. Bibi and Ehud. The enmity between Dagan and Netanyahu reached a boiling point in September 2010. Dagan claimed that Netanyahu had taken advantage of a meeting, purportedly about Hamas, with him, the head of the Shin Bet, and the chief of staff, in order to illegally order preparations for an attack. As we were leaving the room, he says, "Just one moment, director of the Mossad and chief of staff. I have decided to place the IDF and you at O plus 30. O plus 30 was short for 30 days from an operation, which meant that Netanyahu was calling a full-scale attack on Iran an operation, rather than the more appropriate term, an act of war. Wars needed a vote in the cabinet, but prime ministers could simply order an operation. Dagan was stunned by the recklessness. The use of military violence would have intolerable consequences. The working assumption that it is possible to fully halt the Iranian nuclear project by means of a military offensive is incorrect. If Israel were to attack, Iranian Supreme Leader Khamenei would thank Allah. It would unite the Iranian people behind the project and enable Khamenei to say that he must get himself an atom bomb to defend Iran against Israeli aggression. Even the mere act of putting the Israeli forces on attack alert could lead to an inexorable slide into war, Dagan argued, because the Syrians and the Iranians would see the mobilization and could take preemptive action. Barak had a different version of that dispute. He said that he and the prime minister were only examining the feasibility of an attack. But that hardly mattered. The breakdown in relations between Dagan and Netanyahu was irreparable. Dagan had run the Mossad for 8 years, longer than anyone else in history except Isser Harel. He had recreated it in his image, had revived a moribund and timid agency, and restored it to the historical glory it had enjoyed for decades. He'd penetrated Israel's adversaries more deeply than anyone believed possible, had eliminated targets who'd evaded death or capture for decades, had stalled for years an existential threat to the Jewish state. None of that mattered. Dubai was an embarrassment, or maybe just an excuse. In September 2010, Netanyahu told Dagan his appointment would not be renewed. Or maybe Dagan quit. "I decided by myself that it's enough," he said. "I want to do other things. And also, the truth is that I was sick of him." Tamir Pardo, who succeeded Dagan as director, had to rehabilitate a large part of the operations teams and procedures, which were wrecked in the aftermath of the Dubai hit. He appointed N, a man who had been instrumental in planning the hit on Mukhniyeh, to conduct a comprehensive evaluation of the damage, and later made him his deputy. The reconstruction of the operational units did not stop the agency's activities, though, especially not those aimed at the Iranian nuclear project. After a few months in the job, Pardo went back to the targeted killing policy his predecessor had laid down. In July 2011, a motorcyclist followed Dariush Rezaianejad, a doctor of nuclear physics and a senior researcher for Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, until he reached a point close to the Imam Ali camp, one of the most fortified bases of the Revolutionary Guard, which contains an experimental uranium enrichment area. The biker drew a pistol and shot Rezaianejad dead. In November 2011, a huge explosion occurred in another Revolutionary Guard base, 30 miles west of Tehran. A cloud of smoke was visible from the city, windows rattled, and satellite photos showed that almost the entire base had been obliterated. General Hassan Tehrani Mogadam, head of the Revolutionary Guard's Missile Development Division, was killed in the blast, as were 16 of his personnel. Despite the demise of Al-Mabo, arms shipments continued to flow into Gaza from Iran via Sudan. The Mossad maintained surveillance, and the Israeli Air Force kept up attacks on the convoys. The biggest success came after the Mossad discovered that 300 tons of advanced weaponry and explosives, which were disguised as civilian goods and stored at a military compound in the south of Khartoum, were awaiting shipment to Gaza. The arms cache included short and medium-range rockets and advanced anti-aircraft and anti-tank missiles, and was defined by Israel as something that would upset the equilibrium. If it were to reach Gaza, said one of the Amman officers who briefed Prime Minister Netanyahu, we would recommend attacking Hamas even without prior provocation, to prevent them from deploying it. But the arms never went anywhere. At 4 a.m. on October 24, 2012, IAF F-15 fighters attacked the site and destroyed the weapons, as well as the Hamas and Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps personnel who were there at the time. The skies over Khartoum were illuminated by the explosions. Roofs were blown off and windows shattered by the blast. The residents of Khartoum suffered because of their government's decision to allow the country to be part of the terrorist weapons smuggling pipeline. After this incident, the Sudanese authorities told the IRCG that they would no longer permit it. Like his predecessors, Pardo refrained from risking Israeli operatives and killings undertaken in target countries, particularly in places as dangerous as Tehran. All the hits on Iranian soil were, in fact, implemented by members of that country's underground opposition movements and or members of the Kurdish, Baluchi, and Azerbaijani ethnic minorities who were hostile to the regime. These targeted killings were effective. Information reaching the Mossad indicated that they brought about white defection, meaning that the Iranian scientists were so frightened that many requested to be transferred to civilian projects. There's a limit to an organization's ability to coerce a scientist to work on a project when he does not want to, Dagan said. In order to intensify the fears of the scientists, the Mossad looked for targets that were not necessarily very high up in the nuclear program, but whose elimination would cause as much apprehension as possible among the greatest number of their colleagues at the same level. On January 12, 2012, Mostafa Ahmadi Roshan, a chemical engineer at the Natanz Uranium Enrichment Facility, left his home and headed for a laboratory in downtown Tehran. A few months earlier, a photograph of him accompanying Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad on a tour of nuclear installations had appeared in media across the globe. Once again, a motorcyclist drove up to his car and attached a limpet mine that killed him on the spot. His wife, who was sitting next to him, was not hurt, but she saw everything and told his colleagues, horrified at what had happened. Assassinating scientists, whatever they are working on, is an illegal act under American law, and the United States never knew and did not want to know about these actions. The Israelis never told the Americans their plans, not even with a wink and a smile, said the CIA's Michael Hayden. That said, Hayden had no doubt about which measure undertaken to stop the Iranian nuclear project was most effective. It was that somebody was killing their scientists. At the first session of the National Security Council with the new president, Barack Obama, in 2009, Obama asked the CIA director how much fissile material Iran had stockpiled at Natanz. Hayden replied, "Mr. President, I actually know the answer to that question, and I'm going to give it to you in a minute. But can I give you another way of looking at this? It doesn't matter. There isn't an electron or a neutron at Natanz that's ever going to show up in a nuclear weapon. What they're building at Natanz is knowledge. What they're building at Natanz is confidence. And then they will take that knowledge and that confidence, and they'll go somewhere else and enrich uranium. That knowledge, Mr. President, is stored in the brains of the scientists." Hayden made it abundantly clear that this program has no American relationship whatsoever. It is illegal, and we, the CIA, never would have recommended it or advocated such a thing. However, my broad intelligence judgment is that the death of those human beings had a great impact on their nuclear program. The Ayatollah's regime in Tehran had wanted an atomic bomb to make Iran a regional power and to ensure their continued grip on the country. Instead, Israeli and American actions, particularly Israel's targeted killing operations and the virus infections of Operation Olympic Games, had slowed the program's progress considerably. In addition, international sanctions had flung Iran into a grave economic crisis that threatened to bring down the regime entirely. These sanctions, particularly the ones imposed by the Obama administration, including the detachment of Iran from the international money transfer system, SWIFT, were so harsh that in August 2012, the head of SPEAR, EL, estimated that if he could persuade the United States to take just a few more economic measures, the Iranian economy would be bankrupt by the end of the year. And that situation would bring the masses out into the streets again and would likely lead to toppling the regime, he said. Nevertheless, this did not stop Benjamin Netanyahu from making preparations for an open military assault on Iran. It's not entirely clear whether he ever really intended to execute the plan. His defense minister, Ehud Barak, maintained that, if it depended on me, Israel would have attacked. But there are others who believe that Netanyahu, who had the last word, only wanted to make Obama believe that he intended to attack in order to force Obama's hand, to steer him to the conclusion that America would inevitably get embroiled in the war anyway, so it would be better for the United States to carry out the attack itself, first, in order to be able to control the timing. The Obama administration feared that an Israeli attack would send the price of oil soaring, and that chaos would ensue in the Middle East, harming the president's chances of re-election in November 2012. The administration also estimated that Israel was likely to attack soon and worriedly watched Israel's every move. Even regular army brigade maneuvers became a source of apprehension that an Israeli attack on Iran was imminent. In January, Senator Dianne Feinstein met with Mossad Director Pardo in her Senate office, demanding that he explain the reason for movements by Israel's 35th Brigade, as captured by a U.S. satellite. Pardo didn't know anything about the routine drill, but he later warned Netanyahu that continued pressure on the United States would lead to a dramatic measure, and likely not the one that Netanyahu hoped for. Pardo himself believed that another 2 years of economic and political pressure would probably make Iran surrender under favorable conditions and give up its nuclear project entirely. But Netanyahu refused to listen to him, ordering Pardo to continue with the assassinations and the IDF to continue its preparations for an attack. In December, the Mossad was ready to eliminate another scientist, but just before it went ahead, Obama, fearing Israeli action, agreed to an Iranian proposal to hold secret negotiations in Muscat, the capital of Oman. The Americans never told us about those talks, but they did everything to make sure we would learn about them, said a Mossad intelligence officer who discovered the Muscat meetings. She recommended to Pardo that he immediately drop the assassination plan. We must not do this when a political process is underway, she said. Pardo agreed with her and asked Netanyahu for permission to cease the entire assassination campaign as long as the talks were ongoing. It is reasonable to assume that if the talks had begun 2 years later, Iran would have come to them in a considerably weaker state. But even the deal that was eventually struck was an Iranian capitulation to a number of demands that the Ayatollahs had been rejecting for years. Iran agreed to dismantle the nuclear project almost entirely and to be subject to strict limits and supervision for many years into the future. For Dagan, the agreement marked a double triumph. His five-front strategy against Iran had achieved many of its objectives. At the same time, Netanyahu had grasped that launching an attack while negotiations with Iran were underway would be an intolerable slap in the Americans' faces. He postponed the attack again and again, and when the final agreement was signed, he canceled it altogether, at least for the near future. But Dagan was not satisfied. He was bitter and frustrated over the manner in which Netanyahu had shown him the way out, and he did not intend to take it lying down. In January 2011, on the last day of his tenure, he invited a group of journalists to Mossad headquarters and, in an unprecedented move, and to the journalists' astonishment, lashed out fiercely at